Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. News.
MPs have recognized the man-made famine in Ukraine in the 1930s as genocide. Some senators want the president to resign over a controversial pardon. And tax deductions for aid to Ukraine should be approved this week. The Chamber of Deputies has officially recognized the man-made famine in Ukraine in 1932 and 1933 as genocide against the Ukrainian nation. In a resolution passed on Wednesday, MPs strongly condemned this crime and expressed sympathy for the victims' families. The resolution states that in the context of the current Russian war on Ukraine, the Czech lower house expresses its determination to contribute to the promotion of international principles, including identifying the perpetrators of such crimes. The resolution was submitted by Speaker Markéta Pekarová Adamová and the head of the Security Committee, Pavel Žáček. Millions of people died of starvation in the Holodomor in Ukraine. The Civic Democrat and top 09 groups in the Czech Senate say the upper house should call on President Miloš Zeman to resign over a controversial pardon. Senator Miroslava Němcová of the Civic Democrats said on Wednesday that the basic principles of the state of law had been undermined by Mr. President's pardoning of a forestry official working under the office of the president, convicted of large-scale fraud. Senators from the Mayors and Independents said they would back a resolution on the matter, and the Christian Democrats say they will make their own statement. The Czech Constitutional Court has rejected a bid to change the way DNA tests are taken from suspects and prisoners and then stored. However, in a verdict delivered on Wednesday, judges said the relevant section of the law on the police was in danger of being overused and should be employed with restraint. The ruling also included a recommendation that a new law be adopted, taking into account the country's international obligations, the needs of investigators, and the rights of individuals with regards to DNA databases. Czech MPs look set to approve a tax bill that would provide deductions for helping Ukraine during a third reading on Friday. The legislation, which was discussed in the lower house on Wednesday, should make it possible to deduct donations made directly to Ukraine in support of its defence efforts and to NGOs in the country. The Minister of Finance, Zbigniew Stanjura, said the conditions for tax deductions were being expanded in response to Russian President Putin's war on Ukraine. Some 6,708 new cases of COVID-19 were confirmed in the Czech Republic on Tuesday, a fall of around one quarter on the same day last week. The number of suspected reinfections, 1,253, was also down on the previous Tuesday. The number of tests being conducted has also been falling. Quickly, the weather forecast. It should be mainly overcast in the Czech Republic on Thursday with an average high temperature of 14 degrees Celsius. Temperatures are expected to fall on the following days. My name is Ian Willoughby, and that is the end of the news.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. I'm Anna Fodor, broadcasting from our studio here in Prague. Coming up on today's programme: the Czech Republic sends tanks to Ukraine. Brewers hope to add Czech beer culture to UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. And an interview with a British explorer who calls Prague home. All that coming up, so please stay with us. Czech politicians have joined the world in denouncing the atrocities committed by the Russian army in Ukraine, saying that the war criminals must be brought to justice. In the meantime, the Czech government has boosted military support for the country, sending T-72 tanks and infantry fighting vehicles to help Ukraine defend itself. Daniela Lazarova has more.
Expressions of shock, horror and condemnation are filling the Czech social media as more and more evidence emerges of the atrocities committed by Russian forces on Ukrainian soil. The Czech Parliament on Tuesday passed a resolution condemning the atrocities committed by the Russian army in Bucha, describing the mass killing of innocent civilians as a war crime. It also called for the Czech Republic to take an active part in setting up an international tribunal to investigate and prosecute the war crimes committed on the territory of Ukraine. Deputy Speaker of the Chamber of Deputies Jan Bartoszek said the brutality of Russian troops against innocent civilians in Ukraine was comparable with the genocide in Srebrenica and the atrocities committed by Nazi SS troops during World War II. He called for a ban on all Russian banks from the international payment system and for the exclusion of Russia from all international organizations. Foreign Minister Jan Lipovsky said the Russian army is systematically committing war crimes in Ukraine and the perpetrators must be held accountable for their actions. He said present-day Russia was comparable to the Stalinist regime and had nothing in common with the civilized world. There was unanimous agreement in the House that Ukraine must be helped to defend itself, and Defense Minister Yana Chernochova assured the Assembly that the Czech Republic was providing and would continue to provide military support. However, citing security reasons, she refused to confirm that the Czechs were sending T-72 tanks and infantry fighting vehicles to Ukraine.
Nepotvrdím je ani je nevyvrátím. Jenom vás ubezpečím, že Česká republika...
I will not confirm or deny these reports. I can only assure you that the Fiala government is helping Ukraine as much as it can and will continue to help by supplying military equipment, both light and heavy.
Tím lehkým i tím těžkým bude dál.
Czech television reported on the latest delivery of military equipment, showing footage of a train loaded with 5 tanks and 5 fighting vehicles. The information that the tanks and armoured vehicles were being sent to Ukraine was confirmed by the head of the Czech Lehouse's European Affairs Committee, Andrej Benešík. According to the Defence Ministry, the Czech Republic has sent military aid worth nearly 1 billion crowns to Ukraine since the war broke out. The Czech Republic is also said to be considering aid in terms of helping to repair and refit damaged Ukrainian military equipment, and a Czech company, Inžďárna Sázavo, has started printing concrete anti-tank barriers on 3D printers and is considering the possibility of Ukrainians printing them on the battleground as needed.
The Czech Association of Breweries and Malt Houses is aiming to get Czech beer culture added to UNESCO's Intangible Cultural Heritage List. The authors of the application are optimistic about their chances, but warn that it will take at least 4 years before the effort is successful. Tom McEncrow has the story.
While the Czech Republic tends to dominate the annual global rankings of beer consumption per capita, its beer drinking culture is not yet recognised by UNESCO. This could change in the coming years after the Czech Association of Breweries and Malt Houses announced last week that it has sent an application to recognise beer culture as an official tradition in the Plzeň region. Another will soon be sent to the regional authorities of South Bohemia as well. The association's executive director, Martina Ferencová, says that these applications are the necessary initial step in the process of getting the country's beer culture recognised globally.
In order for us to be able to have a chance in the higher categories, we need to get our applications passed through 2 rounds. The first is the regional one. If one of our regional applications is successful, we will then apply on the national level, where applications are approved by the Ministry of Culture. Once that is done, the culture minister can then send an application to UNESCO.
She says that the whole process is likely to take years, but insists that it would be the logical acknowledgement of a tradition that is already recognised by beer connoisseurs in many parts of the world.
It has a history spanning centuries. Czech beer culture has been a source of national pride since the 19th century. But it's not just tradition. Czech breweries remain very innovative with their work, and, of course, it's connected with social entertainment too.
It is not just the country's tradition of brewing lager that has a high international reputation, she says, but also the country's unique malt and hop ingredients.
The skills of our brewers are also highly recognised around the world. Last but not least, it is also a social phenomenon that boosts the good reputation of the Czech Republic in the world.
Placing the tradition on the United Nations' list would not be unprecedented either. In 2016, UNESCO catalogued Belgium's beer culture within its Intangible Cultural Heritage of Humanity list. Mrs. Ferencová is also hoping that the Czech Culture Ministry will play an active role in the process. She says that the Czech Association of Breweries and Malt Houses has been in contact with the ministry already since it started drafting its regional application. Meanwhile, the Bohemian Moravian Association of Mini Breweries has announced that it is also joining the effort. The Czech brewing industry currently employs around 60,000 people. Although beer production and consumption numbers fell last year, it is believed that this was largely due to the effects of the global coronavirus pandemic and of the associated lockdowns.
Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. In today's feature, my colleague Ian Willoughby interviews the British explorer, writer and broadcaster Benedict Allen, who now calls Prague his home.
Explorer, writer and broadcaster Benedict Allen is known for daring travels to such spots as the Amazon, Papua New Guinea and the Gobi Desert. The UK adventurer has documented his often solo journeys in a series of books, as well as TV programmes for the BBC and other broadcasters. However, in recent years, Allen has been in a rather different environment, Prague, a city he now calls home. When we spoke recently, he told me his earliest inspiration was his test pilot father.
He was always travelling away, testing his aircraft in the tropics, and he used to bring back, I remember, a weaver bird nest and then a stuffed crocodile, just a baby stuffed crocodile, an adder that he put in a bottle. All these exciting things made me think there's a world elsewhere, but I think it also made me feel it's possible to do these things. I knew I couldn't be a test pilot, I mean, especially with a nuclear deterrent. I mean, I'm much more passionate than my dad. My dad was very, very steady. But I felt I could do something else out there. And I clung on to this dream of being some sort of, if not pioneer, but some sort of explorer character, someone who's investigating the world. And at school, I was getting a bit desperate about my dream because I didn't seem to have what it took. I mean, I didn't have money was the main thing. But I thought, how am I going to be an explorer, especially when everyone's telling me the world's been explored? And I just thought, I'll give it a go. I worked in a warehouse. I used to stack books in this warehouse, and I got enough money just to go off my first adventure, and I headed off to the Orinoco and Amazon just to seize this one chance I thought I'd get before having what my mum called a proper job. And I settled into this life of being some sort of explorer simply because I found it was possible. It was possible almost entirely due to the local people, indigenous people. I live with the people I used to call Indians, you know, the people of the Amazon, and they kept me alive. And I decided that's the way I would do my adventuring. I wouldn't have much money in my career, but I would go to local people and learn to see places like the Amazon or Borneo or New Guinea as a home and not a threat. Because explorers always talk about the snakes and piranhas and how terrible these places are, but to the locals, they're a home.
You edited the Faber Book of Exploration. Do you see yourself as part of this lineage of great explorers? Or has that all changed now with technology? Because those people, some of them went away for years.
Yep, I do go away for a long, long time. I am part of a tradition. And of course, the British, and I am British, for better or worse, there's a lot of these explorer types. I was certainly in the 19th century. And I'm often regarded as a bit of a relic from a previous era. I'd say what I do is very, very different. Instead of going as an outsider to study people and perhaps expand the empire, which was often what it was like for the British, the locals felt that very much, instead I'm just going to try and listen and learn and immerse myself. So it's a very different tradition from that point of view. It's all about disappearing into a place rather than sort of marching across it. But nonetheless, it has to be said that I am part of a long tradition. And I think it's very important, and I try and stress this whenever I talk to children, that exploration isn't actually something for the past. It seems like it. That's what we're always told. Exploration's over. I was told as a child that it's finished. But the truth is, we don't understand the world, and we need to understand it now more than ever. And so I'm one person who's fortunate enough to follow his dream, and I do what I always wanted to do. But I think, actually, it's about all of us doing the same. All you and your job, everyone in their job, is investigating the world. It's what humans do. In fact, it's what living things do. We all investigate our surroundings. My job, though, is to go out and record and come back, stay alive long enough and come back.
And your approach that you developed was going solo, just by yourself, with a camera, and doing everything yourself.
Yeah, the camera came quite late. I wrote about 5 books, I think, before I did any telly. And then this invention came along, the camcorder. I mean, this is quite a long time ago now, but the video camcorder, everyone's very excited about this thing. And the BBC said, please, can you take this on an expedition? So I was never really a presenter. I was simply an explorer, or you could say an adventurer, or perhaps an environmental scientist, which is what my degree was in. And off I would go on my adventures and record whatever happened. And I didn't know if I was going to come back or not. Obviously, I hoped I was going to. The BBC certainly did, because I had all this footage. And I used to just come back, no health and safety, nothing, no film crew. It was just a proper expedition. And the technology developed, and now everyone does video selfies. But in that stage, it was just me.
And do you think TV viewers today might have different expectations from programmes, given what people have become used to with reality TV and so on?
Things have changed hugely, to the extent that I really was overtaken by everyone else. It wasn't interesting enough to see some bloke walking along through a desert. I walked up the Skeleton Coast, for example, and that journey had never been recorded before. And it was a wonderful thing to be able to do with my 3 camels. And at the time, people were amazed. They're thinking, wow, he's really alone out there. No set-up shots. He doesn't know if he's going to get through this. We don't know if he's going to get through this. And it was enough. But now I look back, as I suppose people were at the time, thinking, it's starting to get a bit claustrophobic. You know, you don't get the beautiful shots. You don't get the beautiful sound. No drone buzzing overhead that gives you the perspective. It's just some bloke with his struggle. I suppose this was in the 1990s. Time moved on and people wanted the beautiful shots. But what, of course, they miss is the real... the jeopardy, the do or die bit. It's you could say it's faked now, or it's certainly staged very much on telly.
You talk about the jeopardy. You were in jeopardy, I'm sure, on many occasions. But still, is there an element of tourism in the kind of trips that you were undertaking? Because you are going for an experience abroad. You are interacting with the locals, hoping to get something out of it for yourself. And you're coming back and sharing your stories. Is that a kind of tourism? Maybe like ultra-tourism, because almost nobody can do this kind of thing.
Tourism, it's funny, I didn't think anyone was quite asked that, because people think of it as immersion. I mean, I'd be going to places that hadn't, not necessarily actually hadn't been recorded, but certainly they hadn't been interpreted, or there were places that were misunderstood, you could say. So it needn't be exploration in that classic sense. I mean, I have made first contact with 2 very remote lots of people who were being overrun by missionaries and so on. But I'd say tourism is probably the wrong word, because it sounds like someone who's just sort of tripping in and out. And each expedition actually would take 6 months, 9 months, a huge amount of time. And in that process, it's all about trying to immerse yourself. So that might mean learning a language. It might mean certainly bedding yourself in to a society and their culture with a sort of considerable commitment. Maybe it's just a personal pride, but I like to think that it's a slight difference between a sort of tour package and what I do. But nonetheless, I do think there's a huge amount of arrogance about the profession I'm in, because by making yourself into a hero, or allowing yourself to be portrayed as a sort of new Indiana Jones, which I've been called, you're sort of using the world as a platform and making yourself better than really you are. After all, in a lot of the places I've lived in, say in the Amazon, these environments have been seen not only as a home, which is the word I used earlier, but as a resource of food, medicine, shelter. They're not places you need to struggle through, and yet time and again on the telly we see our heroes battling against the elements, when the locals I know very well might be just gathering fruit on a day out, you know, as they walk through the forest. So I've got to be quite careful about that in my career, and I think certainly my earlier days I was seen as too heroic, and I've got a new book called Explorer, and that doesn't have me on the cover, and I think it's probably important that it doesn't, because actually the place is what it's meant to be about, not the person.
Reading your biography, you have been in many, many extreme situations that most of us wouldn't last an hour in. But still, what do you regard as the most dangerous situation that you've been in your career?
There have been a few contenders. I was memorably, for me at least, I was crossing the Amazon Basin at its widest, which is something that hadn't been done. I just was interested to sort of do a cross-section of the Amazon. And it took me a long, long time, 8 months. But there was a time I had to pass through Colombia, and I was going down the Putumayo River in a canoe. And unfortunately, I went past the place where Pablo Escobar was hiding out, or at least his intimate team. He was on the run. He was actually killed 6 months later in Medellin. And you know who I mean, the drug baron. And either he or his close associates sent two people to kill me. I mean, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, going right past his camp. He was hiding out on the border between Peru, Brazil and Colombia. And, these two people chased me up the river. And I was just very lucky they were incompetent. they couldn't fire a rifle and paddle at the same time because they were town people. And I wasn't that good at paddling, but luckily I could paddle enough to get around the river bend. And so, you know, scary moment, 6 bullets, I think. They all went past my head. And I got away with it.
Well, now we're a very long way from the jungle. What led you to Prague, Benedict?
5 years ago, I had this brilliant idea. I said to my wife, who's Czech, why didn't we just live in Czech Republic for a year? Wouldn't it be wonderful?
And you guys had met in the UK?
We're living in the UK. I think we've been there 15 years. Everything was going well. We had 3 children. I said, well, let's live in the Czech Republic for a year. And we came over, and we're still here. We haven't negotiated successfully, at least, about whether we're going back again, because my wife says we should be here, and I'm sure she's right.
How did your kids find the transition, just out of curiosity?
They found the one who's now 14. I think for a time she became very much more Czech than British. I think she wanted to feel connected to the space that she'd suddenly been plonked in Prague. My son, he feels he's very British. He keeps on talking about dear old England, far more than me. And the littlest one, who's only 6, she's essentially Czech.
You're known for acquiring skills from indigenous people on your travels. Have you also applied this approach to living in the Czech Republic? Have you tried to go native?
My wife would say distinctly, no, I haven't tried, not tried hard enough. I think she's, my wife's working on it, and I suppose I am gradually adapting. But the truth is that my expeditions have never been close to home, and when I was living in the UK in a place called Twickenham, I'd be launching out into the world, and I sort of mentally, because I travel alone and because sometimes it can be dangerous, I tend to need to think of home as the safe place to come back to. And same now for Prague. But that to me is a good sign. It's a good sign that we are gradually settling into the Czech Republic, because this has become home and it's the safe place that I need my children to be in, my wife to be in, when I go off and do my danger stuff.
One thing I'm curious about is when you go on these solo trips for many months, obviously you interact with the locals to some degree, but you're on your own. How do you adjust back to normal life being around other people after that?
It's always the hardest part of any expedition for me, because after all, I'm meant to be a professional. The business of integrating with other cultures should be what I do. It's my skill set, and for me now, rainforest, desert, the Arctic, I can cope unless I do something really silly. And yet, something as personal, something as unfathomable, really, as the bond you have with your family, it's very, very hard. And it's got much harder since I've had children, of course, but I find it very difficult. When I head off on an expedition, I'm very focused, maybe a bit lonely as I pack and everything, but I have a job ahead of me. Coming back, it's very, very difficult. It's much quicker coming back than going out, because going out, I'd have to adjust climatically and so on, and culturally to people. But going back, you just jump on the plane, and it's very difficult. I tend not to talk about work with people. When I say work, it'd be my adventure, which a lot of people might be intrigued about. But I tend to keep at a distance so that I'm established again as being home and in a different place. But
Is it even weird sleeping in a bed, having heating and all this kind of stuff after you've been
Yeah,
whatever.
It is. I think I'm getting softer. I tend to do allow myself to sleep on something at least when I'm in the rainforest. But yeah, it is. Even something like having to sleep in a room without a window open becomes very hard. I feel claustrophobic. The sounds are different. I remember stepping out of the Amazon when I was much younger and just walking along a road and feeling that surface, that flat surface, I found bewildering. That shows what a sort of state of mind I must have been in. I was so used to walking on roots and mud, and suddenly a surface. At the same time, it is reassuring. But I think the hardest thing is that when you've been in the middle of nowhere, you're longing for home. It's the place sometimes when I've had malaria 5 times, and when you're semi-delirious, you need to believe that you can get back. You need to be able to focus on your loved ones in order to sort of lift yourself out of your condition. And then you come back to the reality. And of course, it can't match up because it's lovely to be with your children and wife, of course. But it's not perfection because life isn't like that. And that is a hard thing to cope with. There's no stimulation, really. You know, it's not like being shot at when you come home. So you haven't got that adrenaline to help you through. And actually, things are quite dull after a while. And that's hard. You've got to fight that and do your duty to your friends and family and try and be normal, which is not easy.
Featured by Ian Willoughby, was first broadcast on 24th January of this year. That brings us to the end of today's programme here on Radio Prague International. You'll find us on the web at www.radio.cz. If you have any comments about today's programme, then please send them to us, either by email at english@radio.cz or on Facebook or via Twitter. We would love to hear from you. I'm Anna Fodor in Prague. Thanks for joining us and take care.